Well, it's always good to start at the beginning, Carolyn. And the things I was thinking to talk to you most about have to do with the development of the Women's Studies program, the early days of that, but also the other community and general feminist activity. So why don't you start by just telling me how you got to Missoula, when you were there, and what kind of a life you had when you were in Missoula?
Okay, I went to Missoula first in August or September of 1969. My then husband Juan was going there to graduate school in zoology. And for a year, I worked as a bookkeeper for a construction company, Felton Construction Company, which did major utilities contracts in all over the Northwest. And I did bookkeeping and accounting. And midway through that year, applied for a job teaching at the university. I had taught English at the University of Missouri for 3 years before we left there. That's what I got my master's degree in, English in Missouri. And there had taught, you know, composition, writing classes, and there was a similar position at the University of Montana, although there was no PhD program, so they didn't use graduate students for the most part to teach the composition program at the university. So that was a job I applied for. They just had by then 3 people, I think, full-time to teach composition, or whatever they call them, the introductory writing class. Mm-hmm. And I started doing that in the fall of 1970. And for the first year or two, kept a very low profile. That was the time of a lot of anti-war activity and meeting a lot of people through groups that were organizing demonstrations and protests, and that's when I first met Stephanie and Barbara and got involved in some women's groups that way. But as I recall, the real impetus for that is that we were involved in sort of Marxist discussion groups about the war and organizing activities for that. And as happened in those kinds of groups everywhere, the women in the group began to think that there would be some benefits in meeting separately and talking about some of these things, just basic dynamics like feeling we weren't being heard in the meetings and that we might feel more comfortable taking more leadership roles and talking more in the meetings and having more input into what kinds of decisions were made about what we were doing if we met separately and talked. I think that's what we were doing, and then we at the same time started doing consciousness-raising groups that were just strictly women's liberation kind of things, but there were also some women who were meeting as kind of adjunct to the anti-war stuff that we were planning. And we kept those kind of separate women's meetings with the other political stuff going for years, because once we got involved in developing the Montana New Socialist Party, we did the same thing. We had women's meetings separate from the general party meetings or larger group meetings, so that just we could get more comfortable talking about all this stuff and not get talked over. I'm trying to think of a polite way to say what happened, but it was just it felt like we were always interrupted. It just was the classic thing that frankly still goes on in any kind of meeting, that a woman says something and there's just kind of polite silence, and then a man in the room says the exact same thing, and 3 other men say, "What a great idea." And you don't want to sound petulant. Didn't I just say that? So anyway, we just thought maybe if we practiced a little among ourselves, we'd be able to make ourselves heard and reinforce each other. So that was kind of going on in the background, in addition to these women's meetings, women's liberation or consciousness raising group meetings that we got involved in at the same time. But meanwhile, back to the teaching, I joined the teachers' union and found a group there who were doing a study of faculty salaries, and just through their study, saw my name there on the list as someone being paid differently from the men in my department, the other two men who had the same job I had. And I thought, I wouldn't have known that because it just wasn't that cool to ask people how much money they make. I had been told the salary for the job, it was a lot more than what I was making as a bookkeeper. It was a lot more than I'd made teaching at the University of Missouri, and I simply didn't question it. I didn't think to ask for more than that. I thought it was a set salary for the job, fine, I'll take it. Then found out I was being paid not that much, like $500 less a year. But I went to the chairman of the department and said, why, I don't know. I don't know if it was suggested that we do this, or I was just curious. But I went and asked him, why am I not making as much money as Lowell and Marshall? And he sputtered a little bit, and he said, well, Lowell has a family to support. Lowell Uda, who had five children, a bigger family than I had, but I did say, well, I have a family to support, too. You remember, my husband is here, a graduate student, we have a child. He's not earning any money, remember? That's part of the whole background when I interviewed for the job. And he said, oh, that's right. He said, also, Marshall he has no children, and his wife works, so that doesn't exactly explain why he would be making more money. And he said, well, they have more experience. I said, really? What's their experience? Well, Lowell taught for 3 years before he came here. And I said, right, so did I. And he said, you did? And I said, come on, Merrill, I thought that's why I got the job. And he said, I guess there's absolutely no explanation for why you're not making as much as they are, except they asked for more. I said, I understand. So I got a little lump sum payment making up for 3 years of pay difference. But the really important part of that for me was that it was kind of cross-department way of meeting a lot of people and meeting some women who were involved in doing that analysis. Men were involved in it too, but there were some other women that were in the union and on that committee that I met then, principally Mary Burke, who was Mary Cummings then. Mm-hmm. And so shortly after that, when I think Judy Smith was probably the first person that approached me to ask about doing something with women's studies. And I talked to Mary Cummings about it, and we started having meetings with other women on the faculty, other people on the faculty, although I first approached. I decided the politic way to do that was to go to the chair of each department, because I went to the chair of the English department and asked if I could do something before we even started doing any interdisciplinary courses. I asked if I could do something on women in literature, and he laughed at me and said, what do you mean? What would that be? A course in, who did he say? Jane Austen, I guess. Or he just named the one woman writer he could think of. And I said, well, if you don't think there are enough women writers to constitute a course in women writers, maybe I could do something on, this was just for freshman introduction to literature class, maybe I could do something where women are characters and just use the books to talk about women in literature. And he said, oh, that might even be interesting. So I did that for a couple of years, and maybe that's why Judy thought to, I think I might have already been doing that just out of my own interest. Or maybe I started doing it right then, I don't know. My original 3-year appointment in the English department was extended at my request to 5 years. And it was just in there at the same time I asked for an extension and to do these new classes that I think we started trying to develop the interdisciplinary thing. And first did a lecture series that I think we called a symposium on women, where we had people from the psychology department and the home ec department and maybe anthropology and sociology, and Judy Smith and probably you and I did just kind of topical lectures. I think
it's
I might
1974, yeah.
Okay, and then we, the same group of people, worked to develop some courses we could offer for credit. I think we first just did a free public lecture thing that we called a symposium. I'm not sure which year that was.
No, it's all in the papers.
Right. And then Mary Cummings and I did a course on liberation and oppression of women that was for credit in social work and sociology, and I think also in home economics. I can't remember how that got into it. And I just was sort of team teaching that, and people couldn't get any credit in the department I was in for that course, but I did some of the lectures and then led one of the discussion groups for that course, which must have been in 74 too. But I wrote this memo to all these, just to anyone. I didn't put names, but I hand-delivered it to women that I knew or had heard of in different departments, asking them to think about what they could do in their disciplines. And some of the reactions, that they're just memorable, because Maxine Van der Wettering, who became such an important person in the whole academic development at the university, and certainly gave a lot of credibility to everything we did, initially reacted by saying she couldn't even imagine what that would be. What was I talking about? It was a little like
Merrill Club's
reaction, but her conversion came within 30 or 40 seconds, and she just started thinking, what could it mean to do history of, and she too thought more of the images of women and the attitudes toward women as revealed in philosophy over thousands of years. Because the first course she taught during that summer was probably women in American history. But then I think I remember a few years later, after I was no longer teaching at the university and was working on another degree in history, I was her teaching assistant when she did one on women in philosophy. Mm-hmm. And that kind of went back to Plato and Aristotle and more history of science and philosophy and perspectives on women. So she and I always had an interest in, I don't mean like she and I alone, but I had a similar interest to hers in the way the dominant culture viewed women and how that affects how women think of themselves. Mm-hmm. More so than didn't think of history of women as being so much about women's movement and women's activities as more the images of women and the roles of women in general in society. So the courses I did in, the initial things I did on images of women in literature were just novels and stories where women were characters. And part of what I took from the other thing going on in my life with women's groups of all types was that in the teaching I did, I wanted to figure out ways to make women in my classes feel more comfortable talking. So I taught a lot of these classes in small group sessions. Though I'd have 30 or 40 people in a class, I would meet with them and never more than five at a time. And if I had whatever number of men, I'd make sure they were spaced out in these groups so that there would be several women and a man. By some point, I remember there were only ever one or two men in my classes, and they were mostly women, so that really, it wasn't that women weren't talking because they felt intimidated by men. But still, women seemed more comfortable if there weren't too many other people around, and you got more interaction going with smaller groups of people. And it was fascinating to me because everybody would have read the same book. This is like the perfect job for me, right? I get to pick books, get a bunch of people to read it, and come and talk to me for hours at a time. And then in different groups, people have all these very different perspectives and reactions to this stuff. So it was It was really the most fun thing I ever did for like 4 years in both the English department, and then when that 5-year thing was over, I taught for 2 more years in the humanities program and developed additional courses in more like the history of women, but used a lot of novels for that too, because I still liked, then it was more traditional and actual history of women in America, but using novels to kind of talk about what women's lives were like. But I continued to do that in small groups, because it is probably lecture once a week and then small group discussions with the literature, just so people would talk more. Meanwhile, it had really caught on with a lot of people in other departments, and really fabulous courses were developed and offered by others that I sometimes got to sit in on, but mostly just would hear about indirectly. I went to everything Maxine ever did, every class she ever taught. But our initial idea had been, I think, that we would try to develop an actual academic women's studies program, maybe not a major in that, but enough courses that someone can really have a kind of emphasis on women's studies with things in various departments. But there was, I don't think we thought of initially that it should be a separate discipline. We thought we should use the people who were already in established departments. And but there's a lot of talk about that, about academically whether that kind of course offering would garner more respect if it were through the departments as opposed to being kind of separate. But the reality was nobody was going to pay anybody in some separate program, so we had to use the people who were already in jobs, mm-hmm. and then wonderful volunteer people like mm-hmm. Judy, who at some point must have been getting paid somewhere, but she seemed to do an awful lot for these programs and classes as a volunteer. One of the indices of how unseriously this was all taken is, I remember when Margaret, then Jacobson, now Kingsland, first came to town, she approached Merrill Club in the English department with an interest that she had in teaching something in women's studies or women in literature. I'm not sure how she phrased it, but he remembered that Carolyn had that same interest and suggested that she go see me. And she and I sat and talked. This would have been in 75 or whatever. But isn't that interesting? What does he think I can do for you? I mean, I'm not in a position to offer you a job. I mean, I'm thrilled to meet you, but you could come and do a lecture in one of my classes. I don't know if you just thought we'd be good friends or what. I mean, it just seemed a way to get her out of his office and out of his face, to send her to talk to me. What are we going to do? It's kind of funny, I think the English department was very ambivalent about the kind of notoriety that my presence there may have brought to them. There were many people not at all pleased that I was doing these not literary things in the, through the English department. And when my contract was finally terminated, my memory is there was some small group of people anyway who were objecting to that. And it was something I decided to challenge through the union and through that other organization of professors. What is that? No, the, like AA.
UTU.
That's the teachers union, mm-hmm. and then there's the thing that Jack Van Wettering was head of. I can't even think of the acronym. Because the problem was, after 5 years, added to my 3 years in Missouri, technically I should have gotten tenure. Hmm. And this, apparently the English department really had overlooked the fact that I had taught before I got there, or they never would have extended my contract to the 5th year. because AAUP, American Association of University Professors, went to bat for me saying, you know, under the professional rules, she really should have tenure now. And I was challenging, just in general, the department's philosophy of keeping people in instructor positions that were not tenure track and then turning them over, which they've been doing for years, you know, with the same kind of rhetoric we challenged everything then, that this was exploitation of people who were, by their own assessments, doing a really outstanding job, but to avoid giving us tenure, they just have to let us go. And the other two, the men who'd started when I had, would have been happy had I been successful in challenging this, but they didn't really add much to my efforts. But both of them were writers, so that their primary interest in life was just having enough money to support their real life's work, which was their writing. Whereas I really wanted to teach and wanted a way to keep teaching, and was told to go talk to the other senior members of the English department and let them explain to me why this was just an impossibility. And this is, mind you, almost 30 years ago, but I will never forget Jesse Beer. When I walked into his office, said, "Carolyn," he knew why I was there, and he said, "I don't want to see your face," and swiveled in his chair and looked out the window behind him during the rest of this conversation. I thought, I don't think I've ever seen anyone act out so literally something they had just said. I was just very struck by that. "I don't want to see your face," meaning I don't want to think about you as a person and what your particular needs are, because I have to do what's right for the good of the department, and that is to make you all leave because we don't want to be stuck with people in tenured jobs who aren't going to be happy here forever teaching only English composition. And, you know, I was a very soft-spoken person, so I just said, "Well, isn't that a little patronizing and condescending for you to decide how I might feel? Wouldn't that be my problem? And if I didn't like the limitations on what I could teach, would it be up to me to choose to leave?" "Oh, but you wouldn't. You would just, you know, pressure us until finally we'd be letting you teach Shakespeare because you'd be a member of the department and we'd have to try to keep you happy." I couldn't just, it was, "But I would be happy teaching this." "No, you wouldn't. We know you wouldn't. No one in their right mind would be happy teaching this for their entire career." So they were very, very, very angry that I had taken this outside the department, because I guess that was the first step, talking to them, and they hoped that that would make me understand. But I did understand, but I still didn't think it was right. And so the union and the AAUP people were doing whatever they did. And ultimately, I had an interview with the president of the university, who said, "You should be happy to know that we're changing the policy. We're not going to allow them to have these non-tenure track instructor positions, but we, of course, can't change this retroactively to your benefit." But by then, I had already been offered this thing in the humanities program, which initially was to fill in for Maxine, who was on a sabbatical or something for a year. And then they somehow found money for another year when she came back. And then they created another position in humanities, but it was going to be half-time humanities, half-time women's studies. And they had 700 or 800 applicants for that job. And I was one of three being interviewed at the end of this long, 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 long process. And I was selected. And Dean Solberg called me in to say, "There's no funding for this position anymore. We're so sorry."
Was that the year that the cuts came to the mm-hmm. faculty, the 70-year?
It was 77.
Yes.
So I think it was about that same time. So I'm not saying that wasn't true, that there wasn't money, but it seemed awfully coincidental. I later learned, though, that he had been visited by a delegation from the English department that was up in arms at the idea of my getting a permanent position in another department. And at that point, I applied to the history department as a graduate student, and I mean, secondhand, learned they went to them too and didn't want them to let me in as a student. So I think people in the English department were really, really upset with me at some very deep level, which is what I meant about ambivalent. I think they were glad that they had someone on their staff who'd been involved in these interdisciplinary programs and the write-ups that this person was volunteering and teaching these mm-hmm. classes across campus, and because there was mostly positive reaction to that from the students and whatever little academic community we were in. But it was like I was this person who had turned on them or something that they thought was going to, they were being very indulgent in letting me teach this thing I wanted to teach that no one thought was very important. And then I tried to turn that into a permanent job against all the rules, which was just not the sort of behavior they were expecting. But I thought it was really over the top to try to keep me from becoming a graduate student in another department. So, gee, this really isn't a very significant position I'm going to hold. Mm-hmm. And I guess they just didn't want me. Didn't even want me in town.
But you did become a graduate student in the history department.
I did. And I was, for a little while, I was a teaching assistant. The program, the PhD program in history was pretty much on its last legs. I might have been one of two people in it. And all of the professors there were strongly urging me to go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I was, at that point, studying late 19th century American social, cultural, and intellectual history, proposing a thesis that was going to be an exploration of, get this, in one study, it was going to be how the great 19th century revolutionary thinkers, by which I meant Marx, Freud, and Darwin, who had revolutionized their respective disciplines, had failed to offer anything of assistance to the development of a critical feminist theory that would have similarly revolutionized the lives of women. And it was all just a takeoff from that one-liner at the end of O'Neill's book about the history of the women's movement, where he said what was wrong with the American feminist movement was that it had had its Lenin without its Marx. That was his summary point about the whole suffrage movement, that women had shown a genius for organization at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, Carrie Chapman Catt and all that, brilliant strategy, but then it fell apart because there'd never been a theory for women's liberation, which isn't that very condescending and patronizing too. And my reading of earlier feminist writing suggested that there had been a lot of work along theoretical lines, but it did seem that there was something missing there that had really could have brought this all together, and I thought it has to be because of the worldview of people at that time, and I'm going to understand this. Needless to say, I never got very far on that project, and after, I can't remember, 3 years in the history department, looking at the ages of tenured faculty in English, history, humanities, it didn't look to me as if I would get a teaching job at any institution for another 30 years, because everybody was my age.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to have to wait till they're all ready to retire before I try to break back into this field, so I think I'll go to law school. No, actually, first I decided I would get the necessary certification to teach high school, and I spent 2 years taking education courses and got my did student teaching even, and got my certificate so I could teach history, English, and humanities, or whatever they called it in high school level, and wrote, I don't know, 300-400 letters applying for jobs all over the world, really, at that point, but not a single answer And that's when I decided to go to law school, which I did in Montana from 82 to 85. And by then, I found law school a little overwhelming in the first year or two, and I pretty much did nothing else except study law, and then got out of town in 85.
And came to D.C.?
No, first I went to Phoenix for 3 years. I clerked for a federal judge who lived there. So I came to D.C. and to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in 1988.
And what do you do there?
I am in the appellate division. We handle the appeals from commission cases, whether they're tried, wherever they're tried around the country. All appeals are handled in Washington. And I'm an assistant general counsel. I supervise 5 attorneys who actually do all that work. I just am in a little tiny teaching role with 5 people who, and I teach a lot of writing and a lot of legal analysis in that job.
Not much,
but not much literature. I keep joining book groups trying to find that that experience again. But people don't read the book, you know. There's no way you can make people read a book and come and talk to you about it unless you're teaching a class.
Good place to stop this side of the table. Okay, Carolyn, let's go back to the beginning.
All right.
Well, one of the questions that I mean, I wanted to talk to you about some of the more detail of some of these, but also somewhat philosophical questions of when did you first consider yourself, or how did you first consider yourself to be a feminist or women's liberation? What made that point of view make sense to you? How did you conceive of it back then, and how has it changed, and what is it now?
I really was one of those people who had that click sensation that between one minute and the next, it seemed a whole lot of things fell into place. And it was in sometime between the fall of 69 and the fall of 1970, somewhere in there, through reading something in Sisterhood is Powerful, or just hearing somebody say something, I don't know. I can't really remember the moment of the click exactly, but it was initially for me more of a realization that a lot of the internal doubts and limitations were a product of a kind of cultural conditioning, that some of the expectations I had about what it's okay for me to do or want to do were a product of having been brought up female. So, and by that I mean that I got married when I was really young, 18 or 19, and had a child when I was 20, I just turned 20. When we were married, we were both students, and it just seemed to me, if I'm married, that means I do all the housework, all the laundry, all the cooking, all the shopping, all the caring for the child. I didn't question that. My mother had been a very, and is still, a very strong woman, but she had very traditional ideas that these are women's responsibilities. So she had actually really wanted me not to ever marry, and was extremely disappointed when I got married that young. But I knew that her view was you had to choose between marriage and career, and that she thought I should choose a career. But her career aspirations for me, when I was 16, she suggested that I consider seriously going into either space science or television, because those were the fields she thought, and we're talking in 1959 or something, she's telling me this, those were the fields she thought would be dynamic in the future. And I said, but this is me. She was so disappointed when I majored in English and taught English, because that's what she had done, and she just wanted me to do something. She she would have considered more exciting. So she especially didn't want me to get married, and I was a sophomore in college when I got married. She certainly didn't want me to quit school, so she gave us a little financial assistance, but she also gave me a lot of stern talk about how, well, you've done it now, but you've got to keep this house and keep everything going on an even keel and make sure that there's no stress for Ron, because he, you know, needs to concentrate, needs to study, needs to, I said, I also need to study. Said, well, you're just going to, you know, not sleep, because you've got to do all this. And I just remember, I mean, I think of her giving me that message even more than my husband did, who probably wouldn't have been that demanding about how the house was kept. But whenever she came to visit, I was just like a tornado trying to get the house clean, so she would really believe I was able to do all this. And that's just, I thought that was necessary. So the most obvious thing I remember changing was, like, between one day and the next, this isn't fair at all. You should be doing half the cooking, half the cleaning. Mm-hmm. And because he was at the same meetings or reading the same thing, he said, you're absolutely right. And it was overnight a complete equalization, as we thought we could call it, of that kind of stuff. And I mean, we were rigid about it. It was like dish for dish, shirt for shirt, we were going to split everything. And I had to learn to drive, which I didn't know how to do at the time. And then I had to take equal responsibility for car maintenance. And if there's a flat tire, is it my turn to change it or your turn to change it? There wasn't anything we were going to accept that was, you know, in either one's sphere of responsibility, decision making, or anything else. So in most ways, life got a lot easier at that point, because I think I was doing way more than, you know, my share of everything. After a couple of years, we reverted to things you really hate to do, maybe you don't have to do. I didn't like shopping as much as he did or whatever, and he hated to do laundry, so I did the laundry.
How much was your early consciousness and development of feminism, or the women's liberation movement, related to your involvement at that time in more a Marxist perspective on what was going on with politics and anti-war activity?
Well, I did. I was involved in Marxist discussion groups and study groups, and read Marx and Engels stuff on women, and the historical analysis there made a huge amount of sense to me. So it was kind of intellectually satisfying that kind of gave an explanation that I could live with, that wasn't as, I mean, the Marxist perspective attaches less significance to biological difference and more to the kind of economic forces that may have necessitated particular divisions of labor, and that women being relegated to caring for children may have made sense in certain kinds of agricultural economies that it's no longer necessary. It just kind of all fit and made it seem like this should be easy now that the technology is here to control reproduction. We don't have to be, women in general don't have to be caught up through their whole lives in the routine of having babies and caring for children. And then, so it even seemed real true to me in a way that the material conditions for liberation were somehow there because of the development of capitalism, and that there was a possibility of women's actual liberation. But what that meant to me was liberation from the traditional role and exclusive responsibility for the private sphere. But because of my kind of other intellectual interests or academic interests, I was reading lots of history. Besides Marxist theory, I was reading a lot of history, and it just all seemed to fit to me, that why it was that this, by the way, the end of the 60s, early 70s, there's kind of a academic revolution in every field, and in historiography, by the time I'm studying that at the end of the 70s, there's, you know, this view that history has too long been written by the winners and reflective of the perspective of the dominant class. And so even for people who weren't Marxists, there was a lot of interest in writing what the underside of history, and writing from the perspective or about the perspectives of various minority groups and women. And it just sort of all seemed to be bubbling together. Mm-hmm. But the important thing to me personally was that I thought the oppression of women had a really profound psychological effect on women, that women felt inferior. They are viewed as second class in various ways, and many women had really internalized that. I also knew a lot of women who were very strong and very positive about who they were, and just seemed to kind of blow off the whatever they thought was the negative perceptions of the dominant men in their lives. And I mean the working class women that just sort of laughed at men and sort of had their own culture and sisterhood and all that. But I wasn't a part of that. You know, mm-hmm. I'm in an academic class or whatever where these negative judgments of the men about women's abilities had probably really had a pernicious effect, you know, that having been interested in Western culture and read all this stuff and sort of imbibed it from an early age, it had not escaped my attention that there didn't seem to be women who were writing works that we were studying hundreds or thousands of years later, the way mm-hmm. Shakespeare and mm-hmm. Dostoevsky. Where are these women? So it was just, I don't know why, I hadn't been exposed to this stuff before, but reading Virginia Woolf on A Room of One's Own, getting some understanding of why historically women weren't in a position to make those contributions, instead of thinking it was, you know, something inherently limited in women that kept them from, and also realizing that our sense of what is good art or literature or architecture or anything else is mm-hmm. shaped by who's doing it, and, you know, the control over those values, those patriarchal values that may have caused us to overlook
many of the
women who were doing these things for centuries.
Those things that you're saying seem to me to be so much at the core of what much of the energy of the early women's movement, particularly academically and in the development of women's studies, focused on mm-hmm. was addressing those very questions that you're raising right there, that shift in perspective. Are there other ways that you, or how do you think that actually change? Do you think it was that we have made a significant change in moving from one perspective to a more diverse or perhaps even more radical perspective in looking at history and culture from a different point of view as a result of the development of feminism or women's studies?
Well, you know, I'm not in the academy anymore, so it's now from a kind of outside perspective. I assume we must have made some significant changes because of the level of anxiety there is in academic institutions about this new multicultural perspective, the threat to the traditional canon. I mean, obviously every school I'm aware of teaches a lot of mm-hmm. courses that reflect the contributions of all manner of people who wouldn't have been considered, you know, worthy of study 30 years ago.
So how was that struggle in that, say, 10-year period for you or among the faculty at the University of Montana? Because, as you said, some, such as Maxine, in one second would have said, well, is there really anything to study? And in the next second, instantly got it and could move forward on that. And other faculty members totally denied it, probably still do, but many others went through a much slower process, probably, of coming to grips with that information. How did that kind of a perspective or information even get infused within the faculty? Were there seminars? Were there just ongoing discussions? Do you think it was just part of the general cultural discussion? Or how did those of you who were on the faculty trying to move some of those issues do that?
I don't know. I mean, I think in that little microcosm in Montana, it was a small faculty, and if people knew someone in their department who's now offering these courses, if they were involved in team teaching them or whatever, if they just were at all open to talking to that person, they would say, well, what are you doing? I mean, I had a conversation with someone in the history department who objected to the idea of women's history. Usually the academic objection to it was, how can you isolate out and look at something from that perspective? You've got to be doing the whole story. And he said, and this is one of the people I respected most in the history department, said, if that's legitimate, why shouldn't I be teaching Irish history, Irish American history? And I said, why, Dave, I think you should.
And now he is.
And I think something clicked in his head at that moment, too. Why not? Because, I mean, but his historiography goes back and forth from the view of what is the proper way to look at American history. Do you see it as some universal movement in some direction, or point-counterpoint?
Mm-hmm.
So historical, the trends in historiography as to what's even appropriate way to think about history keep changing, and I don't know where they are right now, but I think just hearing what other people are talking about opened others' minds to, mm-hmm, this could even be interesting. And I think the interest of students in it spurred others to get interested in it. As students get interested and they want to do papers and do research of their own, I mean, a body of scholarship begins to develop. I don't know so much at Montana since I'm not there anymore, but certainly everywhere else, mm-hmm, it's a huge, thriving discipline. And I think that people, men or women, who want to teach these things or make this their research area have often experienced significant difficulty being taken seriously and getting tenure in traditional departments, because there's still a predominant view that there's something kind of faddish and not really academically sound about these approaches.
And you on the faculty were involved at all when, I believe it was the Faculty Senate invited Women's Liberation to come and do a presentation to one of their meetings about Women's Liberation. Were you present at that? This was the session which Barbara Kozer, I know, organized at Koenigsberg at the time, and I was involved in it. And they were meeting over in the science building, and we had developed a little skit guerrilla theater piece for the entire time, which started with coming dressed as all the stereotypes of women in the culture and coming in singing Ain't She Sweet, Making Profit Off Her Meat, one of the anti-Miss America songs, and then reading all of the different sort of sayings about women and folklore about women, and going through a lot of the different statistics about going out and pinching the men and saying, oh, this one's cute, look at him.
I was not at that meeting. I'm sure I remember this.
Judy McVeigh coming in toward the end dressed as Wonder Woman, wearing a gun, and reading March Piercy's, one of her poems, We're Not Going to Take This Anymore, Power, mm-hmm, to the Women. We're all out rolling and laughing to death in the bathroom thinking, these guys are just horrified, totally paralyzed. And that was our invitation. They extended an invitation to actually come and talk, which I believe we did after that. But
I'm sure that got their attention.
Yes, it also got the attention of the paper, as I recall. Mm-hmm.
I was in the Faculty Senate 1 or 2 years, but if I was there that year, I didn't go to that meeting, and it seems I would have known,
mm-hmm,
about the program when you were preparing it. So if I'd been a member, I surely would have been there.
Were you involved in the preparation of the proposal to the Faculty Senate for the establishment of a women's studies program?
Yes.
With Maxine. Why don't you talk some about that? Because we have the draft document that you have that looks like Maxine prepared, which was the argument for it. And then Gertrude Lockshavitz, as I recall, wrote and led the response.
You know, maybe I wasn't by that time, because that's probably... Do we remember what year they did that?
74, 75?
I just don't remember meeting with Gertrude and Maxine on that. Maybe that was...
Gertrude was in opposition to it, and the debate in the Faculty Senate was predominantly between them, but not solely between them.
I think all I did was talk to Maxine about, you know, the content of what was written up. But there may have been, you know, some reason to want to keep me in the background by that time. Mm-hmm. Because of where I was with the English department. Because that was the year that I was challenging their decision and raising hackles mm-hmm. all across the campus.
When you were talking about the first teaching of the first Maybe Symposium, and then it became a regular class, being taught in a pretty different manner than traditional courses had been taught, where you had a faculty member who designed the course and basically taught the class by themselves. And yet those first courses that were offered were organized somewhat differently and led differently. Would you talk about that?
Right, and it's really the only experience I ever had with a kind of team teaching approach where a group or even just two, but usually way more than that, because for the symposium it would have been five or six people brainstorming about what the content should be, you know, meetings to talk about who would do what and what was a kind of logical progression in the topics and who's best to cover certain topics. I remember we really wanted something in psychology, but we didn't have a woman in that department. We didn't know if we had anyone who'd be interested in talking about the perspectives of that discipline on women. I think the initial symposium, we really were thinking very broadly. I mean, receptive to anything anybody thought they could do on their discipline and women, whatever that might trigger in their minds. So it was just kind of a fun experience and different from the way, say, the English department decides what courses are going to be offered and what texts can be used. Because we were just free to do what we wanted, and people were very respectful and receptive to any ideas you had. That's something that probably changed as the discipline became more entrenched academically. I'm sure that even people doing women's studies now are a little less free than we were in the beginning. We're just using a lot of, you know, radical press stuff as texts, and no one is saying, you know, that's really not an appropriate thing to have people reading, because we're just making it up as we went along.
I think that's one of the more stunning things that I tell people, or their reaction is more stunned to it, is to say, we made it up.
Right.
It was literally making it up, whether people had certain credentials or not. I mean,
right.
it was a time in which there was more permeability between the traditional academic world and people who were interested in this material intellectually, but may not have those same credentials or hold a position at the university. The materials came from a lot of different places.
And I think the other thing that's built into the way we were doing it, or to our perspective or whatever, was a whole lot more interest in generating discussion and having interaction between the people who came to hear us and us. You know, it wasn't just lecturing and walking out. It was stimulating discussion and hoping something more would come out of that than that people would take notes on what you said as if it were received wisdom. So I thought always those classes were a lot more dynamic, and people argued with us about what we said, or disagreed, or got upset, or agreed and wanted to talk more, or, you know how they could pursue some of these ideas further, which was the whole point with the first symposium, was just to see, is there some interest in this? Because people couldn't, I think what we thought was you couldn't really go to your